DW Deutsche Welle. World in progress.
Hello and welcome to World in Progress. I'm Jessie Wingard in Bonn. Coming up on the program, a pilot project in Brazil gives legal land titles to residents living in one of Rio's poorest favelas.
What we are doing is to give them the same level of rights that these people will have if they live in the formal city.
Also on the program, acid attacks leave victims scarred for life.
I never go out. I can't face the public. Before the attack, I would. When people looked at me, it was fine. Now when they look at me like I'm strange.
And North Korea's government is expanding its reach to the Cambodian restaurant trade.
Are you going to try the dog?
No.
Why not?
I want my mother to still love me.
Your mom a dog lover?
Oh, yeah. A dog.
Well, I'm loving this dog right now, actually. It's delicious.
All that and more coming up today on World in Progress. But first, Rio de Janeiro is getting ready to showcase the city to millions of international visitors when it stages the 2014 Soccer World Cup and then the Summer Olympic Games in 2016. Many of the city's residents still live in precarious housing situations. That is, they have no legal right to the properties in which they live. But one organisation in Rio is trying to change that. They've launched a pilot project which aims to secure land titles for residents in one of the city's biggest favelas. If successful, this scheme could spread across the country, giving residents of shanty towns renewed hope of claiming land entitlements. From Rio de Janeiro, Sam Cowie reports.
Rio de Janeiro's favela Cantagalo is situated on a steep hill, nestled between the world-famous Copacabana and Ipanema beachside neighbourhoods. Da Rocha has lived in the community for over 40 years. She takes a break from hand-washing clothes in front of her two-bedroom red brick house, where she lives with her three young grandchildren.
I'm really happy because they'll never be able to take us away from here and put us somewhere else. We have the right now to live permanently in the community. I have three grandchildren that live here with me. I'm really happy that I've got something to pass on to my grandchildren if I were to pass away.
Maurel was recently awarded a document that entitles her to the legal ownership of the land her house is built upon. The result of an ambitious project in the favela, Projeto Cantagalo, that aims to give legal land tenure to the owners of the 1,500 or so properties in Cantagalo, undertaken by NGO and think tank Instituto Atlantico. Like most of Rio de Janeiro's favelas, Cantagalo, which means the crowing rooster in Portuguese, started as an informal squatter settlement. Today it is a bustling and vibrant community, home to some 6,000 people. In December 2009, Rio de Janeiro's military police established a permanent fixture in the community, chasing out or arresting drug traffickers who had controlled the favela for decades.
What I hope is that things continue to improve and there will be better facilities in the community for sport and cultural activities for our children and grandchildren in the future.
Previously, and as is the case with the majority of favela dwellers across Rio de Janeiro, Mara lived in precarious uncertainty, having built a house upon state land without state permission. In reality, she had no legal protection or entitlement to her property. Carlos Augusto Junqueira is head of the legal team working with Instituto Atlantico on Projeto Cantagalo. He explained some of the obstacles that favela residents face by lacking land titles.
They cannot borrow money using the land as a collateral for the debt. They don't have formal address. These people that live in favela, they cannot receive a letter from the mail. They don't have any proof that they live in a favela. And basically what we are doing is to give them the same level of rights that these people will have if they live in the formal city, basically.
The project began in 2007 when the favela was still under the control of the drug trade. The first land title was given last year. Since then, 44 of an estimated 1,500 property titles have been realised. 67-year-old Luis Bezerra is a retired bus driver who also heads the Residents Association of Favela Cantagalo and has worked closely with Instituto Atlantico throughout the project. He has also lived in the community for 50 years. From the Residents Association's office at the bottom of the favela, he explains the impact the project has had on the community so far.
One of the first and most important benefits is the value of the houses. In the past, the most anyone could get for a house here would be 30,000 rias. Now, the highest value that has been obtained for the sale of a house is 140,000 rias. So people are going to feel more secure. They will have to bear some extra costs, but they know that they have the benefit of security. In addition, they will have the knowledge that the value is only going to increase. Once the whole process has been completed, you won't be able to buy a house for less than 300,000 rias.
As a result of being absorbed into the formal city, the residents of Cantagalo will face extra costs, the most expensive of these being property taxes. However, plans are in place to ensure that these changes are gradual. Cantagalo will become what's known as a bairro popular, or lower-income neighbourhood, ensuring that residents won't pay the same hefty land taxes as their counterparts in Copacabana or Ipanema, which have some of the highest property taxes in Rio de Janeiro. One of the key principles of Projeto Cantagalo is that by empowering the property owners, the project will also stimulate local economic growth. Roberto Carvalho is the vice president of Instituto Atlantico.
But what kind of economic impact you're talking about? I would say that there are three pillars for that structure. First is the government, once is giving the title, has to provide the access and also a little infrastructure. So there are some investments on that plan. A second, then inhabitants. They also will start a new phase of their lives, thinking about having a better home. So they, of course, will invest small amounts of money, but anyway, the total will be a huge investment. And also the private sector, included in the private sector, also the neighborhood surrounding those areas.
Another resident happy with the development is 80-year-old Laia Gomez, who has lived in the community for 75 years. She was awarded her land title last year, shortly after her husband passed away. Knowing that the house was hers to keep, she spent a large portion of some money left to her investing in the 3-bedroom house that now boasts new beds, furniture, and kitchen features.
I'm very happy. I'm really very happy because now I really am the owner of the house and it can't be taken away from me. It's mine and I can enjoy it. I'm very happy. I have 9 children, 11 grandchildren, and 1 great-grandchild. All of my children have their own houses, except one of my daughters, who lives in the house with me. I'm really happy that I'll have this place to pass on to her.
Essa casa ficará para essa filha que mora comigo.
With only 44 completed land titles so far, Projeto Cantagalo still has a long way to go before realizing its goal of securing legal land title for all of the Favela Cantagalo's property owners and incorporating the neighborhood into the formal city. But for Laia Gomez, Amaro La Rocha, and their families, after years of uncertainty, the future now looks a lot more secure and settled. Sam Cowie for DW, Rio de Janeiro, Brazil.
Wheat is one of the key staples with fast-growing demand in Africa. The increase in consumption is driven by income growth, urbanisation and dietary changes. But sub-Saharan countries and Africa as a whole only produce about 40% of their own domestic requirements. This shortfall has led to a heavy dependence on overseas imports. Meanwhile, international food and energy prices are soaring. But researchers at Mexico's International Maize and Wheat Improvement Centre, or CIMMET, have come up with a solution. They say with the use of rainwater and proper fertilisers, a greater portion of African farmlands would be suitable for profitable wheat farming. Anka Rasper spoke with Hans-Joachim Braun, the head of CIMMYT, about their latest findings. She began by asking him how important wheat is in sub-Saharan Africa compared to other staples.
Wheat is currently not an important staple in sub-Saharan Africa, with the exception of Ethiopia, Kenya and South Africa. So it is not a widely grown crop. But historically, we know that wheat has a very high yield potential in many wheat areas of Africa. And we also have noticed that the demand for wheat and consequently the import for wheat is growing faster than for any other staple. And that has various reasons. One of the reasons is that there is a demand for diversity in diets. And wheat can provide this diversity. And the other reason, and possibly more important, is that there is a very strong migration to the cities, in particular of males, and males prefer convenient food, and wheat is a very convenient food because you can buy it easily and you can store it also for several days. So there is a very growing, strong demand for more wheat in sub-Saharan Africa. And for this reason, we have decided to make a big study for potential of wheat in sub-Saharan Africa and look where wheat could be produced from a biological point of view, where wheat could be produced economically, and where wheat eventually also would be competitive with other crops, because no farmer will switch to wheat just for the sake of wheat. A farmer will always choose the crops and the crop rotations with which they make most money.
You're just mentioning money and economic benefits. Now, one of the reasons why this could be a possibility for sub-Saharan Africa is that export prices, or in that case, import prices for wheat, are really high at the moment. What's the current price for wheat on the market at the moment, and who benefits, and how much economic benefit could be reaped from producing wheat locally in Africa instead of importing it?
Well, the wheat price is currently far above $300 per ton. It's approaching $400 per ton. And that, of course, is for the main exporting countries. The entire continent of Africa has imported last year wheat for more than $12 billion. That was for grain. And then one has to recognize that also there are huge imports for processed wheat products, because the processing industry in Africa is not very strong, except for North Africa.
If you say $12 billion of imports into Africa last year, how much of that could instead be produced locally, do you think?
It's not just the question of producing it. There is also the issue that many of the production areas are not close to the big cities, where the wheat consumption is mainly. And so we also need to look at the local infrastructure. Are there roads from the production area to the main cities? Because many times the transportation, let's say from Canada to a city in Africa, could be cheaper than transporting the wheat from the production area in a country to the main cities. So all of this needs to be looked at. But from a biological point of view, we know that Africa has a huge potential, in particular in the highlands of Africa. And historically, some of the highest yields were obtained in those regions. In Ethiopia, we have areas where the yield potential is as high as in Germany, also in Zimbabwe under irrigation. So the potential is there, but the question is to utilize the potential, and also the question is whether the infrastructure will allow to transport the wheat at reasonable prices to the main markets.
What makes wheat such a valuable crop and valuable staple food?
Well, wheat is globally, on a global level, the most important source for calories and for protein. And in developing countries, it's the most important calorie source after rice and by far the most important protein source. So that is why it's so widely consumed. Also, wheat can be processed in many, many products, and that's why it's by far the most traded commodities of all. And wheat also can be processed into products which can be stored.
There are still around 1 billion people in the world today who are undernourished, malnourished, and many of them do live in Africa. Which role do you think can wheat play in the future for feeding the world?
Yes, Africa has the highest percentage of malnourished people, but the highest number of poor and malnourished people live in South Asia, where wheat is the main staple together with rice. For Africa, I think that wheat can play an important role, but I do not believe that wheat in the near future will replace some of the current staples like maize or cassava. But wheat will allow to add diversity, and it also will allow farmers to have a more diverse cropping system, and by this, diversifying their income. And I mean, just also diversifying risk. If you only produce cassava or maize, if something goes wrong, then your income is gone. And I think if farmers have more diversified crops, crop rotations, that also will allow them to diversify their risk.
World in Progress's Anka Rasper speaking there with Hans-Joachim Braun, head of the International Maize and Wheat Improvement Centre based in Mexico. You're listening to World in Progress, DW's Globalisation and Development show. It's now time for this week's development news. Andre Leslie joins us in the studio with the wrap.
Millions still going hungry. One out of every eight people in the world is chronically undernourished, according to the United Nations. In a new report, three UN agencies warn that although progress has been made to reduce world hunger, the process has slowed since the global economic crisis in 2008. The UN estimates that 868 million people were going hungry between 2010 and 2012. That's down from about 1 billion 20 years ago. José Graziano da Silva, Director General of the UN's Food and Agriculture Organization, said that although the figures are better than expected, a recent trend in increased food prices over the past few months will likely see numbers get worse before they get better. A world first. The first UN International Day of the Girl takes place this week. To mark the occasion, a team of UN experts have called on states to increase the age of marriage to 18 years of age for girls and boys without exception and adopt urgent measures to prevent child marriage. Every year, an estimated 10 million girls are married before they reach the age of 18. Child marriage occurs in many parts of the globe. 46% of girls under 18 are married in South Asia. But the phenomenon is also prevalent in parts of Europe and North America too. Angry locals in Brazil. A protest involving one of the planet's most threatened native tribes, the Awa, forced Brazil's largest iron ore mine to temporarily suspend operations along its main railway line. Hundreds of indigenous locals took to the tracks of Vale's Carajás Railway to voice their opposition to Brazilian government plans that could weaken their land rights. The demonstration follows months of anger surrounding a draft text called Directive 303, which prohibits the expansion of indigenous territories. The government has refused to scrap the proposed directive, despite it apparently violating national and international laws.
Andre Leslie there with the development news. Cut off from much of the world by a secretive military regime, North Korea is perhaps the most isolated country in the world. But even dictatorships need an income, as DW's Jared Ferry found out when he visited a North Korean government-run restaurant in Cambodia. There, he was greeted with a music and dance performance that accompanied his meal. But North Korea's strict rules were on display that night. When customers brought out their cameras, staff told them to put them away immediately. Needless to say, none of the waiting staff could be interviewed, and the sound for this piece was recorded secretly on a mobile phone.
At this restaurant in Cambodia's capital, Phnom Penh, waitresses in colorful outfits serve up traditional dishes like kimchi, a spicy Korean treat made of fermented cabbage. More exotic fare is also on order, stir-fried frog as well as dog stew. As diners at our table dive into these delicacies, a group of women in traditional outfits performs on stage, playing music and dancing.
Are you going to try the dog?
No.
Why not?
I want my mother to still love me.
Your mom a dog lover?
Oh, yeah. A dog.
Right. Well, I'm loving this dog right now, actually. It's delicious.
The performance and the food provide a rare glimpse into the world's most isolated country. The restaurant is called Pyongyang, named after the capital of North Korea. This is one of a number of restaurants around the world with the same name that are owned by the North Korean government. They're scattered throughout Asia, and there's also a few in eastern Russia. The first outlet in a western city opened up recently in Amsterdam. Sebastian Strangio is a Phnom Penh-based journalist who's visited these restaurants in cities including the Bangladeshi capital of Dhaka and the Russian city Vladivostok. He's written articles for the American magazine The Atlantic about this chain of North Korean government-owned restaurants.
They're doing it basically to raise currency. It kind of dates from the fall of the Soviet Union, when the North Korean state lost a lot of its preferential access to cheap Soviet goods. And since then, the economy's been in such a terrible state, they're doing everything they can to try and get their hands on hard currency. And one of the things of the last sort of 10 years or so has been opening these restaurants abroad. And they don't make a huge amount of money, but I think for the North Koreans, any small amount of cash is welcome and needed.
Sebastian has also written about the plight of refugees who have escaped the secretive dictatorship of North Korea, where food shortages, hunger, and even famine are all too common. The refugees he's interviewed show physical signs of malnutrition, which is not the case for the waitresses and performers at this restaurant.
You can tell that these women are relatively well off by how tall they are. If you meet most North Korean defectors who fled the country because of starvation, from rural areas of the country, their growth is stunted, really. And so you can immediately tell that they're from sort of the showcase capital. And anyone who's allowed to reside in the capital has to be from a sort of political class which is privileged.
Sebastian says these women go through intense training, learning music and dance, before they are sent to Pyongyang restaurants for stints that can last up to 3 years. For them, it's a rare opportunity to travel. Most North Koreans are not allowed to leave the country. But even these women are restricted once they get to their work placements.
They have to live on site, so they live upstairs from the restaurant. And they are restricted from moving around the city on their own. I think they get taken out on trips to the market or whatever. But I've heard from some people that they actually station North Korean security agents on the premises to kind of keep watch over the women. There have been cases in China of women defecting, and given how paranoid the North Korean leadership is about defections, I think that would be a constant threat, even though these women, as people from a more privileged section of society, probably be less likely to defect than your average North Korean.
At Pyongyang restaurant this evening, middle-class Cambodians, South Koreans, and a smattering of Westerners are enjoying dishes that average about $10 each. The atmosphere is festive, to say the least, and the food is delicious. But the environment also highlights the harsh conditions that the majority of North Koreans face daily. In Phnom Penh, this is Jared Ferry for DW.
Acid throwing is becoming an increasing problem in many countries around the world. Horrific attacks maim and disfigure their victims, and physical and emotional scars last a lifetime. Many survivors spend years waiting for their attackers to face justice. Some never get their day in court. Cambodia is one such country struggling to deal with these vicious attacks. Our correspondent, Erwin Loy, visited some of the survivors and has this report.
For 24-year-old Rit Sovan, the January morning started like any other. One moment she was preparing breakfast. The next moment, a woman from her workplace approached her. What came next would change her life forever.
She wanted to talk to me. I said, "We don't have anything to talk about." So she shouted at me, "You'll see the end result." I looked up and she threw acid at me.
The searing liquid left painful scars on her body and down one side of her face. Savan says her attacker was a woman her boyfriend used to date.
They loved each other a long time ago. She thought if she couldn't have him, then nobody else could have him either.
It's been months since the attack. Savan now spends her time on this quiet farm outside the Cambodian capital, Phnom Penh. It's a refuge for people like her, men and women, who have survived debilitating acid attacks. Here, she receives treatment for her wounds, but it's not just the physical injuries that trouble her.
I never go out. I can't face the public. Before the attack, I would. When people looked at me, it was fine. Now when they look at me like I'm strange.
The emotional trauma is just one part of what makes acid crime so horrific. Ziad Saman is project manager with the Cambodian Acid Survivors Charity, or CASC.
It's not intended to kill the victim. Not many cases of acid attacks result in death, but it's this idea that they will spend every day of their life, you know, walking around with these scars, marked.
Acid attacks are a global phenomenon. Countries like India and Pakistan are struggling to contain the violence. For the past decade in Bangladesh, more than 100 people each year have become victims of acid attacks. In these countries, the problem is perceived to be one of gender-based violence. The majority of victims have been women. But here in Cambodia, that's not necessarily the case. Of the more than 300 attacks CASC has recorded since the 1980s, the numbers of men and women have been more evenly split.
It's very difficult to pigeonhole this issue in relation to sort of like one sort of cause. And I think a lot of it comes down to a lack of conflict resolution. People don't necessarily resolve their issues or their conflicts until it gets to a point where everything bubbles up and then they act.
Though the motivations behind the attacks may vary, one crucial problem fueling the violence is the wide availability and inexpensiveness of acid. In Cambodia, you can buy sulfuric acid in markets for less than $1 a liter. Advocates for acid burn survivors want to see the dangerous liquids strictly regulated. Authorities have made moves to curb the violence. In recent years, courts have more frequently prosecuted perpetrators. And last year, the government passed a new law specifically targeting acid violence. It mandates tough penalties, including lengthy prison terms, for those who are convicted. But authorities have yet to introduce sweeping restrictions on the sale of acid. Without this, advocates say, acid attacks will only continue. For now, acid burn survivors here are trying to rebuild their lives. Som Bunarit wants to put his life back together through his music. 7 years ago, his wife threw acid on him. The attack has left him nearly blind, but he's learned to adapt. He uses a walking cane to help move around. He says he can't get his old job back as a soft drink salesman, but as a peer counselor here at CASC, he's trying to help others who are going through what he did. And he's singing songs about the problem to raise awareness about the issue.
The message of the song is stop acid violence, because acid is a cold killer with a hidden face.
Bunarit says he's made peace with his wife. The most important thing to him now is to provide a good education for their 3 teenage children.
This story is all in the past now. Now, I only think about trying to work hard and making money for my family. I don't want my children to be ignored and not get a good education. So even though I'm blind, I keep trying so that my children can study. That's my position.
For others, though, the wounds are still fresh, and moving forward is a long process. Rit Sovan feels fear when she thinks about her attack.
I'm still afraid because they haven't arrested her yet. Maybe it could happen again.
Her case is still working its way through the courts, and the woman who doused acid on her face for now remains free. Erwin Loy, DW, Phnom Penh.
Well, that's all from World in Progress on DW for this week. Remember, you can keep up to date with development and globalization stories at dw.de/globalization. World in Progress will be back again at the same time next week, so be sure to tune in. We'll be celebrating International Rural Women's Day. I'm Jessie Wingard in Bonn. Hope you can join me again next week. Thanks for listening. Bye for now.